Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hi. This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
FM Riverside
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery. Of course, I'm Al Warren, and Mr. Dave Martino is back from his live karate.
Live karate. So live Marshall. Live Marshall.
Live,
but it looks
live.
Like live Marshall.
Yeah.
That's could be live or live.
Death.
I was thinking live like Liv Tyler.
Well, that's spelled differently.
That's right.
And you're a writer. Come on.
Yeah.
Liv Tyler.
I thought of that. I thought, well, that's how people would know.
You're giving away your age, too. Liv Tyler's not the kid star anymore, right?
Yeah.
She's probably a grandma somewhere now.
That's right.
Like Jennifer Beals. She's probably knitting in a rocking chair.
That's right.
You know, it's crazy.
Me too.
Well, yeah, but you're a different story.
Yeah.
You've been doing that since you were 20.
Yes.
Well, let's just get into it. This is the big day, Friday, end of the week. People are running home. So we'll give them something to run from. So we've got an author today, and he is a big seller. He's done, over 90 books. And sold over a million. So he's up there in your league there, Dave.
Oh, yeah.
So, Mr. Robert J. Crane, thank you for coming on the show.
Hey, I appreciate you having me on, Al, Dave.
Well, Robert, you've done a lot in this writing world. Did you always know you were going to be a writer from the get-go, from age of four type thing, or did it happen late?
It's funny you say that. Yes, I did know early, but it's one of those stories where there's a lot of sidetracking along the way. So I knew I wanted to be a writer fairly early. I completed my first book, quote unquote, in like fourth grade. And everyone's praising, oh, it's so great. I can't believe you actually wrote a book in fourth grade. This is amazing. It's five pages. My talent for art has diminished in the years since. It's not kept up with the talent of the people my age. So now my skill is exactly the same level as it was when I was 10.
Perfect.
But I went to college and got a degree in English on the creative writing track thinking, yeah, I would love to be an author. And when I got out of college, the professors in the few creative writing courses I took were very frank about it. You know, the path to publication involved at the time getting an agent, querying publishers to find one that will like your book. And then you're going to publish about one book a year, and probably 95% of authors aren't going to make a living at it. So this is going to be a hobby thing for you. You probably need to go get a master's and teach English if you want to do this. And so I was very discouraged by that. It didn't seem like a particularly viable career path. And so I put it aside and went into the financial services industry to try and find a way to make money. And then after about 10 years of beating my head against the wall, dealing with mortgages, investments, and insurance, I finally reached the point where, you know, maybe actually writing books, I should probably get back to that because this other thing is not working out for my sanity or really at all financially, because it was right at the time of the financial crisis. So no one really wanted to talk about mortgages or investments for some reason.
Yeah, but so what made you go? I asked this because I think it's a tough career choice to be doing any type of work and then to decide to go into writing, because it's like you say, it's not an easy thing. Even today, there's a lot of self-publishing, and you still have to do a lot of promoting and marketing, and there's if anything, self-publishing, there's like 1,000 titles every day that you're competing against, so you're overwhelmed. So is there something that actually lit the fire to make you, okay, I'm going to write a book, I'm going to find an agent, I'm going to publish this thing? Was there something that drove you to that?
Well, I did. I had an idea in my head that I just simply could not get rid of. It was the concept that became the Sanctuary series that I wrote. And I would go to work in the morning in financial services, and I'd be thinking about story ideas as I was doing the sales calls that I had to do and whatnot. And I just could not stop thinking about this. And I started writing it in my spare time in the evenings, just, a chapter at a time, whatever. And pretty soon I was spending just hours and hours, on my evenings and weekends writing. And so I started looking into, how do you become a professional author, a published author? And I was very discouraged by the traditional route, the querying, the publishers, because I had an idea, and it was an epic fantasy series. I just finished writing the 12th book in that series. It's coming out in June. And I just didn't think that in general, I'd have a lot of luck selling a publisher on this particular concept over the course of 12 books. And, I'd get one book out or something, and they might cancel the series, which does happen sometimes, and I'd be out of luck. And so when I looked, I did discover that in self-publishing, there's a lot of, like you said, stuff that you have to do and to promote yourself. But it gave me the freedom to be able to hold a series through until I felt like I'd finished telling the story I wanted to tell. And so I decided to go that route. I looked into what the people who are actually having success at self-publishing were doing, and I followed that path, and it worked out really marvelously for me. I think actually we're at over 3.5 million books sold at this point.
Yeah, you sleep with a lot of people. And get
Yes, they fall asleep reading my books. It's not the equivalent, unfortunately, because I think I would be dead by now. And so, I mean, it worked out really well for me. Dispositionally, I do a lot better with the self-publishing side of things because I've done a few public events here and there on my own dime as an indie author, but interfacing with the public, doing a book tour or something like that is not what my introvert heart wants to do. Instead, sitting myself in a chair and writing for 6 hours a day, 5 or 6 days a week is definitely more up my alley.
Well, how does one do this then? What's the secret to being successful in self-publishing to the extent you are?
I had a very fortunate start early on. I was able to, Amazon used to have the ability to set your books free permanently. And you could, so I write fairly long series by disposition. My upcoming release in May here, Shadows, it's book 54 in a series. And I was only 8 or 10 books deep in the series when I started having success. But what I did is I set the first 3 books free. And I said, hey, try my writing. I know you've never heard of me. Give this a shot. Read the first book or 3 books. If you like it, here you go. You can keep reading more. And at that point, you'll be paying me. But up till then, it's a free sample. It's a loss leader the samples in Costco as you walk down the aisle.
Right.
And it worked marvelously. I hooked people in my writing, made lifelong fans out of them. And so many of them have been around from the beginning. So that was what I did at the time. Nowadays, it's, a little more complicated. You still have to adopt the basic precept, though, which is you need to get people to want to try your writing one way or another. I suggest hostage situations.
Yeah. Well, do you think output itself, putting out all those books, has worked better for you than interactions with readers? Do you think that just creating a large volume of work has led to your success?
Well, as a certain 20th century monster said, quantity does have a quality all of its own. and so, yes, I mean, there is a certain amount of, bludgeoning the reader I can do by just flooding their inbox with 10,000 emails about how many different books I've published. But I mean, there has to be a certain level of enjoyment they derive from it, but absolutely. It does make it easier when you have, I'm writing my 99th book right now. It's easier for me to have 99 books to sell to people in 10 different series rather than if you've got one author who has two or three books out there, and then they have to continuously flog those two or three books in order to, you know, establish the number of sales that they would need in order to make a living on a yearly basis.
Well, I noticed you're quite the series writer. And when you do that, like you were saying, you know, book 54, book 55, how does that all stay in your brain? Like so many, you know, editions of the same sort of story, and quite often characters or theme or world, I guess, if you create a world, like where does this, how does this happen?
The series that is my longest is called The Girl in the Box. It deals with one main character who is, it's like a superhero movie with a thriller or mystery twist. And there's a lot of things you can do in the superhero genre in terms of genre bending that isn't necessarily available to an author. Like in my epic fantasy series, I only had so many epic fantasy stories in me before I had to kind of wrap that one up to a close, because you can only push the bounds of one character so far in an epic fantasy situation. I mean, eventually, you know, they get tired of the epic battles. They, you know, they've fought their last fight. It's over. Whereas if you think about the Marvel Universe as kind of an example, you've got one book or one movie that's Guardians of the Galaxy. And then on the other hand, you've got Captain America, the Winter Soldier, which is a political thriller or a thriller in general. And so having that kind of superhero template to work with, I can write a mystery one book, and then the next, like the one that's coming out on the 2nd, May 2nd, is it's a spy thriller. And so having that breadth of options available to me allows me to not get stuck writing the same kind of character in the same situation over and over again. It allows me to really push her in some different directions. But that said, it won't go on forever. I'm probably in the last stretch of 10 to 20 books at this point, I would say.
We can only live in so many boxes.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, with your series, how do you deal with continuity? You know, remembering continuity? Do you have tools? Do you have a process? Do you have a series Bible? How do you do that so that everything stays consistent throughout, 50 books?
I have a pretty good memory to start with, so that is a key point for me, although it's not as good as it was a few years ago. But I do have a series Bible that's updated by my last stage proofer. Every time I finish writing a book, she updates it and then sends it back to me with the final revisions. And then I have a series of advanced review readers that read it and let me know, hey, you might have messed up this, and if it's serious, I can fix it. It's rarely, most of the time, I pretty much catch it almost all the time by myself or with the help of one of my editing steps. I have three different editors, I should say. I have an editor and then two levels of proofing after that before it even gets to the beta readers. And so, in general, I'm able to keep the continuity pretty straight in my own head, either through my own memory or the series Bible. Although occasionally I did forget that there was one character a couple of books ago. I had to thank one of my fans because I was interacting with fans on social media and I said, oh yeah, I've got this character is going to come back and, you know, he's going to do something or another. And this one very voracious reader said, you do remember that he's pretty evil. I'd like to see him get a bad end. And I thought about it. And I'm like, what happened with him? When did he go evil in sight, chapter and book? And I go back and I'm like, oh my gosh, I had forgotten I had done this with this character. And so I adjusted the story accordingly, thanks to my reader, David Miller, managed to give this evil, evil character the proper send-off instead of making him comic fodder and allowing him to continue living in the universe.
Yeah, worst thing in the world is to bring someone back to life that they're dead, you know.
He wasn't dead. He was a pretty bad guy, though, and I had let him get away with it, so.
So your characters like that, like they're really bad, evil kind of people in these fantasy books. How do you kind of feel them or get them so that they seem real? Like people buy into these evil characters. And is it hard for you to write bad people?
No, it's scarily easily, which should worry me more than it probably does.
So you live alone?
No, I'm married and have kids. But when my first book in the series came out and the main villain was a serial killer, one of my wife's coworkers read it and asked her, you know, do you worry about him that he's able to write this kind of stuff? And she said, well, I didn't before, but now. Yeah, I mean, I've studied criminology quite a bit. I read criminology books for fun in my spare time. I read a lot of history. And so it's not very difficult to tap into the vast reservoir of terrible people and come up with the, you know, the common threads that bind them to humanity, the parts of ourselves that we really don't want to acknowledge. So I just try to just put their humanity in there one way or another so that the reader will hopefully not see too much of themselves in these characters. But I will say that one of the villains I created who was a serial killer, and I ended up eventually killing him, and readers to this day beg for me to bring him back from the dead because they like him so much. And I can't. I think I did too good a job because he was appalling to me. I wanted him dead. I was sick of writing him.
I guess a lot of bad characters believe they're doing it for the right reason, or they believe what they're doing is something that's good, or there's definitely a reason. Do you sort of explain that with your characters, or do you not write that type of bad character? They're just evil right through.
No, I mean, I think in modern storytelling, you can't get away with this character is evil because they're evil. They have to have some sort of perspective that allows them self-justification. But in a lot of these cases, I feel like we've kind of filed the edges off, because a lot of these really bad characters or really bad people, they didn't necessarily think they were the good guy. They just thought, in some sort of grand sense of story, it was that they thought they were right. Someone annoyed them. Someone wronged them. Someone gave them a grievance. And so, I mean, in some cases, villains can be villains because they're petty and mean and had, you know, some small things go wrong in their life that they just held on to, let themselves get bitter. And so however I go about it, whether it's a villain who's got plans to destroy the world or whether they're just planning a murder that they're hoping they can get away with, I mean, I just try and ground it in a feeling that the audience can see, I guess, or can empathize with, would be probably the better way to put it.
So are you real conscious of how you display and write, let's say, your violence and even sex on the page?
I try to avoid, in most of my series, I do have one series where there is sex on the page quite a bit. Most of my others, it's fade to black. But I mean, in terms of violence, yes, there are, I have not tended to flinch from being extremely violent on the page. I guess that's a more American way of doing things, but, there's no, sex is terrible, but show someone slitting 18 throats. That's fine.
No, that's good.
But yes, that tends to be the way I approach it.
When you're doing this, like a fantasy book, now for someone that's old like me, mm-hmm. how do you, as a successful fantasy writer, describe what it is that you're writing? Because someone like me, I lump in all of science fiction. All of that seems to be the same to me. Mm-hmm. And yet I get told, well, this is a fantasy, young adult, you know, I get all these different terms, but to me it's just all science fiction. They're traveling in time and there's a weird world and evil monsters. I don't know. How do you define fantasy?
Well, I think there are so many categories that it does make it more difficult than in the days when, say, the only one thing anyone knew was Tolkien and The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit, for instance. It's experienced quite a renaissance since then. And I mean, even when you look at, say, Amazon's top 100 fantasy list, you're likely to find more of the, what you call urban fantasy, the you know, magic in a modern world type stories than you will the old swords and sorcery, a group of travelers banding together to fight a dragon in a strange, foreign land. The way I typically would describe it to readers is I try to relate it. It's so painful to do it this way, but you kind of have to relate it. You either have to have a hook that is instantly understandable, that they will grab them immediately. That's probably the preferred way. Or you have to have some sort of way to relate it to what they've read in the past. You know, like I would typically, if I'm in a hurry, describe my epic fantasy series as Lord of the Rings meets Game of Thrones. It's not the most artful way to describe it, but in marketing terms, if you've got 50 words to work with, it gets the basic point across so that someone knows the genre. They know it's maybe not as dark as Game of Thrones, but probably not as light as Lord of the Rings. And so, I mean, whereas, you know, Girl in the Box, I would say it is technically considered contemporary fantasy or urban fantasy, but I would describe it as more like a superhero meets a thriller detective sort of tale. And so typically, yeah, I go with relational terms where I can explain to people, it's like this and this with a dash of this thrown in order to just make it so that I don't have to build the description of the genre from the ground up, because brevity is, I was going to say the soul of wit, but it's such a cliche.
It's still all the same to me, Lord of the Rings and Game of the Thrones. I wouldn't see them different.
Yeah, I mean, it's a difference in tone, really. You know, Game of Thrones is a lot darker, you know, a lot more political in the sense of the grand sweep of evil machinations, of the people vying for the throne, whereas, you know, Lord of the Rings would be more driven by the nobility of man trying to defeat the evil villain who is truly just evil, rather than in Game of Thrones, the competing political interests where people come off evil because they're more self-serving. So I guess it's really just a difference in worldview, probably. But do you see the difference, though, between, you know, contemporary fantasy where it takes place in a modern world where it has some element of magic versus the medieval type worlds?
Well, I can see the difference, but I don't really think they're different.
Okay.
If that makes sense. Like, I still put them in the same,
yeah,
same category. Like, I still, if I feel like science fiction fantasy, as it's called now, it wouldn't matter to me one way or the other. If I feel like that, that's what I feel like.
Yeah, I guess when you drill down or you get deep into the genres, like I grew up really reading sci-fi, but not reading fantasy. So if you gave me a book that had starship captains sweeping across the heavens, discovering new alien species and whatnot, I was all about that. But if you tried to give me a book where a bunch of wizards and warlocks and swordsmen and knights were going to ride horses across the land to go defeat the evil dragon lord, less interested in that. That wasn't really my genre.
Right.
But, and that's the difference between sci-fi and fantasy. But they have a lot of fan overlap. And, you know, if it's not a genre that interests you, then, you know, why bother to categorize them that deeply?
Well, how did, that brings the question to, how did you get back into or get into epic fantasy as you were more into science fiction?
I really played a lot of fantasy video games, even though I didn't read the fantasy genre. And then eventually I started to read the fantasy genre a little bit, and I discovered Tolkien. I read Lord of the Rings finally, and I really loved that in college, along with The Hobbit. And then I ended up discovering Brandon Sanderson, for instance, who is just a phenomenal, phenomenal writer, and obviously a legend at the top of the fantasy genre, as well as Jim Butcher, who writes The Dresden Files. His series is just amazing. And I mean, those and my own experience, again, in video gaming really drew me to that world, because I really was more of a sci-fi or classic, you know, Clancy thrillers type reader before that.
Jeez, you know, my name should have been Butcher right in True Crime.
That's a really good name. Exactly. for a
yeah. Yeah. I told myself I should have been Al Butcher.
You could still be Al.
I still can, yeah.
You could do it.
I'm going to write this down.
With your epic fantasy, I was just wondering, where do your characters come from? Are you drawing from mythology or tropes, or do you create your own unique outlook on the fantasy genre?
I mean, you can't play in the genre without at least playing with the tropes. The main character for the majority of my epic fantasy series was the classic warrior archetype, but I just tried to take him in some different directions, give him some different flaws. He's definitely got the wrathful barbarian thing going for him. He's a man kind of out of place. He's more ambitious and less loyal at the outset than you would probably prefer in your typical fantasy hero. And so that's the fun of it for me, is to like take him through a character arc where he sheds that, he builds that loyalty. He sheds that, that ambition that, is not serving him so well. And so, you definitely have to at least acknowledge the tropes, And then go in the opposite direction of them or do something, because there's just so much content in all of these genres nowadays that if you're not aware of what, at least a baseline understanding of what has happened in the biggest names in the genre, you probably end up writing something that's a little too close to what other people have done in the past.
Right.
And don't get me wrong. There are some fans that, you know, just give me more of this forever. I don't think it's necessarily a winning strategy in the long term to not iterate and at least create something new if you're going to play in that genre.
How do you describe your relationship with your characters then? Like, and I say that because we get all sorts of answers from family, friends. They're talking to them all the time and all this stuff. Like, where is it for you?
I am their butcher. Let's go back to choosing my name. I have a bit of a reputation for swinging the axe on them when at the slightest provocation, or when the story calls for it. I like my characters. Some of them I really love, but if the story tells me to go in a certain direction, they're unfortunately going to be sacrifices to the story. It's just the way it goes. Nothing personal.
Look out for the family. No wonder she's worried. If that's what needs to happen, that's what's going to happen.
That's a different kind of story. I'm not in control of that one.
Oh, yeah. Well, so when you do that, when you're working out these characters and stuff like that, are you drawing them from people that you know, or maybe someone you've run into, maybe someone cut you off in traffic, or someone butted in line at the grocery store, and you kind of pick up their character a bit, and then you decide, okay, I'm going to make you suffer in this book?
I cannot say I've ever done that, where I've just directly taken a character or someone I've run into and really just drop them into the story without alteration. I'll take a characteristic of someone. Best example I can think of, actually, I was on a flight one time, and this is before you were allowed to keep your electronics going all the way into landing. There was this guy who, I mean, he was working on a laptop feverishly the entire flight. And then the overhead announcement comes, you need to shut off your devices. We're about to enter below 10,000 feet. He fights it all the way up until the stewardess comes over and tells him, you have to shut this. He shuts it, and then he pulls out a tablet and works feverishly on the tablet hidden. And finally, he gets caught doing that. And he has to put that away, and he pulls out his phone. I'm like, this is the most connection-addicted man I've ever encountered in my life. And so, I mean, that characteristic made the basis of a character. I'm thinking, like, what is he working on? What sinister thing could he be doing? And so I made that a character in the open of one of my books. And so I typically would take that, where it would be like, I saw this behavior, this attribute or something, and I would put it into a character, but then I'll, you know, the character I wrote didn't look anything like him. If someone cuts me off in traffic, I typically forget them 5 seconds later. If I remembered, yes, I would schedule them for a terrible execution, but it would have to be kind of anonymously. And I would, I always try to take, if I see something, and meld multiple characteristics together, because the intention was never to, you know, just take life and throw it into the book. The idea is you want to put some creative work into it and make it fit for whatever you're doing, if that makes sense.
Well, we've got the guy on the line, the other line here, that cut you off in traffic last week.
Tell him I'm sorry. He's in the next book after this one.
Perfect. Speaking of this, do you hear your characters? Do you have an inner monologue? I'm just trying to find out for your wife if you're hearing voices.
I do not typically hear my characters. I don't talk for them. I'll typically give them an accent, and then I'll let it play out. If I'm writing the dialogue, I got this advice from Tom Clancy at one point. He said, you need to say your dialogue out loud, because if you say it and it doesn't sound like a line even you can deliver and you're writing it, then it's probably not something someone would say. I mangled right. That. That's not his actual quote. But the spirit is the same, in that you should probably speak your dialogue out loud in order to make sure it sounds somewhat reasonable. And so I do that, and I'll throw in a bit of an Irish accent and see if this one character talks in this particular way. And that's kind of how I'll field test it. But I don't
I don't hear them as really living people in my head. I'm forced to come up with their lines for them, and I'm keenly aware that it's me trying to think about it in terms of, well, this character has this terrible backstory that's nothing like my upbringing, and so how would he think about this situation? And so
that's good. I mean, you know, you're not driving down the road listening to someone telling you what to do.
Well, I am when I drive with my wife, but other than that.
I will cut that.
Go ahead. She'll laugh. She's got a great sense of humor about this.
So what comes first for you? Is it the character? Is it the plot? Is it the setting, location? Like, how do you start out with one of these books?
Typically, I write a more plot-driven series. And so, I mean, that doesn't mean that I don't want to focus on the character somewhat, but, you know, the thriller and fantasy genre really does tend to, at my end of the pool, turn more on the plots. And so I typically want the basic setup, at least, in mind of what is the character and the problem that they're going to face in basic terms. Now, sometimes that means the character is unformed in my mind. It's just a basic, oh, you know, this is the person. This is what they're struggling with. And then you should flesh them out from there. But the setting is typically the last thing that I will think about. I'm not as good as a lot of writers. I mean, there are some writers that, my gosh, you open their book, you open Jim Butcher's Dresden Files, and Chicago just comes off the page at you. Or again, Sanderson, I mean, his worlds leap off the page. I think mine are definitely more in the background and subordinated to the character and the problem that they're dealing with.
Right. They drip off the page. So what do you hope people get out of your book? And I mean this in the sense that, is there a subtext? Do you have meanings behind the entertainment, the thought in the book? Is there some sort of relevant subtext?
Often, but I mean, I try and put it somewhat in the background. Every book has a theme, an argument in my head that I'm, you know, weighing. Should it be this way? Should it be that way? And I'll have the characters ask the questions about that. In fact, one of my proofers sent back about my most recent release. Wow. Wouldn't it be great if there was a philosophical argument in the middle of this book? And I mean, he tagged it right at a place where I had just let them have a philosophical argument. So just pointing out to me, hey, your subtext is showing. And so I have all that in there. I'm not very fussed if they just want to read, if readers just catch the main plots. That's fine with me. That's how I operated for almost all my reading life until I took a theories of literature class and I started to realize there was some deeper stuff going on in most of the stuff I read. And so I put it in there, but, you know, readers don't have to catch it in order to enjoy it.
How do you think when you finish a book? I mean, you've got so many. I don't know if you noticed, but when you finish a book, do you feel there's a slight change in how you write for the next book?
I noticed it a lot more in the first 20 books. Every single book at that point, I would focus on a different element of craft and really try and make this book the one where I write excellent description, and I probably went over the top on that particular book. You know, the next one I might focus on really hitting the plot beats with maximum emotional effectiveness. And nowadays, I think it's pretty settled, and the stuff I think about is more little tweaks here and there. There's definitely not as much of a step change as there was back when I was earlier in my career and really focusing on a lot of the fundamentals as I wrote. So
a little bit more natural now, I guess, at this point.
Probably a little too natural. I probably need to read a craft book and focus on something for a little bit in the next book or two I read. And I do still read craft books and from time to time, and I try to, you know, make one a focus of a book, but it's a lot less often than it used to be.
Right. Well, you're getting old.
I am.
What makes a good book for you?
As a reader or as a writer?
As a reader, like if you're, when you pick up a book and stuff, let's say, whatever, just randomly pick up a book and you start reading it, what is it that keeps you there? What's good?
I'll give you a couple of examples. I read a couple of books this weekend, one of which was the aforementioned Brandon Sanderson's newest release, Tress of the Emerald Isles. It had very imaginative world building. It had a protagonist that hooked me instantly. She's just this kind of sweetly naive and endearing character, and the arc of the character that she goes on is really impressive. I mean, it was just very well done. Another book I finished this last weekend was the eighth book in Marco Cluze's Frontlines series, which is a military sci-fi book that I've been reading it for about 8 or 10 years now, I guess. And it's about a soldier in a far-flung war 150 years from now against aliens that are the size of buildings. And that was another one where I read the first book in the series, and it just gripped me from the first page. His descriptions were so-so, but the narrative voice in that one was what hooked me. Actually, the narrative voice in both of these descriptions was really tremendous, both Sanderson's and Cluze's books. Cluze's is this really familiar feeling you get. Cluze had a background as a soldier in the German army, and so he had that air of authenticity where he's not been to war in space, but he's clearly done the work of being a grunt. And so it had that feel about it where it was just, this is something unique, it's different, and the narrative voice just hooked me and dragged me along. Whereas in Sanderson's case, he's telling it from the story of the narrator is, the story is about a girl who's going through an impressive quest, but the narrator is actually this ultra-powerful, world-striding being who's just sort of focused in on the story. And again, the narrative voice is very, the character's name is Wit, of the narrator, and he really is a funny narrator, and it allowed Sanderson to do some stuff with this one that he doesn't typically do in his, you know, giant doorstopper epic fantasies, where the jokes are made right there in the dialogue and they just hook you and keep you going. And so for me, I love a good narrative voice. It doesn't have to be that sort of first person like those two are. I'm reading a Chernow's Washington biography of George Washington, nonfiction. And that one hooked me too, because Chernow is just really confident in how he tells the story of Washington's life. So for me, I mean, the skill of the writer, the narrator, is everything, because the old saw about show, don't tell. If you've got a really skilled narrator, they can tell you some things and you'll keep going. Whereas if you've got a really unskilled writer, in a lot of cases, they can tell you and you're just going to want to bash your head against the wall, because what they're telling you is not something you care to hear.
With the world today and social media and all that stuff, do you interact on social media a lot? Do you have a website? Where do people find you?
I do have a website, www.robertjcrane.com. I used to be very active on social media. Around 2020, I started posting silly memes, and Facebook moderation started banning me for 30 days at a time for them. So
it sounds like hell.
It was for the dumbest things. I posted a meme about Jeffrey Dahmer that got flagged for COVID misinformation. It was a joke. And then they, I guess, unbanned me and said it wasn't COVID misinformation. And then they hit me with a 30-day ban because it violated community standards. I didn't even republish it. They just republished it themselves. So I'm not as active on social media as I used to be. I keep an eye on it in case someone writes to me, but yeah, definitely I'm more on my website or behind the scenes. I can't do the full on social media interaction anymore. Not an expect to write as many books as I do.
Well, does that sort of thing affect you? Like, you know, stress and stuff, like you're getting canceled on Facebook, or you know, the COVID sort of situation and all that. When things are stressful outside of your home, does that affect your writing, or you can just write no matter what?
I can pretty much write no matter what. I wasn't able to write as much during 2020 because my kids were home for the first part of the year. And so I was trying to help them homeschool and Zoom class and all of that fun stuff. But I wasn't terribly stressed. I don't get terribly stressed about the events of the world because I have no control over the events of the world. And so if it's something that's in my control, I might stress out over it a little bit more. But in general, it irritates my wife because she's like, how can you be so calm about whatever is going on at the moment? There's not a lot I can do about it, and I don't like to lose sleep, so.
You get canceled tomorrow. What are you going
to
do?
It'd be really hard to cancel me. I mean, I don't have a publisher that can fire me. I don't care what people think. I have a solid core of readers who seem to like my work, and so I'll just keep writing. And if they want to cancel me, I'll just log off the internet for a few days, and they can just, you know. The thing about cancellation nowadays is that if you have a publisher, you can get in real trouble. They can obviously drop you. As an indie author, I mean, Amazon can be capricious. I don't want to suggest they can't. They just canceled a friend of mine's account on Amazon, his publishing account, because they said he violated copyright on a co-authored book that he wrote with someone else. Yeah, and so that kind of thing does happen. But typically, they don't take your books offline unless you are violating their terms of service in some way. And he's working his way through that with them right now, and hopefully we'll get his account back. So I don't say it's impossible. I mean, but my typical strategy, if I say something that's, you know, going to tick people off, I'll just log off the internet for a few days, go enjoy my life, you know, sit out on the front lawn and sun myself where people, you know, who aren't very online don't know what's going on with my cancellation, and talk to my neighbors, and come back in a few days when the Fuhrer has moved on to someone else.
Well, it's probably not going to happen, but I just thought,
it could happen.
It could, but well, you know, most of it, again, it's cancellation if you want it to be.
Right.
You know, unless you do something really, really nasty, there's really not much you can, you know, people cannot follow you for whatever reason, but it's not really that much of a change in your life. That's how I feel. I get it all the time, so I don't really notice much difference. People take it too seriously.
Oh, yeah, fair enough. I was going to say, back in the old days, they said, you know, everyone gets their 15 minutes of fame. I feel like in the new world, everyone's going to get their 15 minutes in the barrel, which is the cancellation.
I've been trying. And I'm still here. God, you know, what do I have to do? Well, so what's going on? What's next for you? I guess you probably got another dozen books coming out this year.
I write somewhere between 6 and 8 a year lately. I almost released 10 one year. Back when I was co-authoring, the best year I released 19, and I wrote 9 of them myself and then 10 of them with my co-authors. But I am much slowed down. I don't co-author anymore. It's just me and my editorial team cleaning up my mistakes, the janitors of my literary career. So probably 6 to 8 books this year. I'm going to start a new series next. I've got to do something different. I just wrapped one up. I'm going to wrap up another series at the end of this year. And
well, I've got one for you. How about The Boy in the Box?
Well, you know, I think there's several movies about that, and they're not appropriate for all audiences.
How about The Boy Has a Box?
And now we're all canceled.
See, I'm trying to get canceled here. I'm doing what I can.
A worthy effort.
Doesn't happen. Yeah, well. So, well, fantastic. Now, of course, we'll have everything up on our website so people can find you and your books and your website and stuff, and it's been fascinating. And we appreciate you being on the show.
Well, I appreciate you having me on, Al and Dave.
Yeah. So we got Mr. Robert J. Crane and his newest book, look for it, is called Shadows. And it's The Girl in the Box, book 54. Again, thank you.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.